Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing and why the more grapes you eat, the healthier you are. And also what we can do to prevent some cancers like lung, prostate, pancreas, and leukemias using natural techniques. Also tell you about why taking a power nap is so important for you. Then a newsmaker update. I want to share more on the GMO battle that is going on. I'm inviting from the UK Heidi Stevenson, a leading health advocate, award-winning investigative journalist, to talk about gene silencing and its risks from the RNA and GMO wheat. And this is stuff that has not been discussed in the United States. What could happen? Then I'm going to ask her about Gardasil destroying young girls' ovaries, literally taking some girls, 14, 15 years old, and throwing them into menopause. Literally happening, not a speculative concept, actually occurred. So we're going to look at that. Then I'm going to set aside probably half of my program today to offer a progressive rebuttal to both President Obama and Mr. Romney. I will deal with these issues in a way that is a little different than what the left would, who seems to apologize constantly for Obama, like The Nation magazine. I'll give you a true progressive, which they're not. Very few people on left radio are actually progressive. But I'll give you a true progressive perspective on the issues that are most important, with details and scholarship and references. None of the mumbo-jumbo nonsense that you heard last night. It was just terrible. But that's coming at you in a few moments. Let's begin. For those of you who eat grapes, hopefully organic, because otherwise grapes are heavily sprayed, or take grape concentrate or grape powder, however you get the grapes in you, it's all good. This is from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetic Food and a nutritional conference on this topic. And what they found was, looking at the best study, they followed 21,000 children and adults for a five-year period. And they found that those who had the most grapes had also the highest dietary fiber, most vitamin C, B6, potassium. All of that was good for them. So grape consumption is linked to a healthier eating habits. So I guess they're supposing that if a person were conscious enough about their health choices to want to have grapes, they would be conscious about other choices they made as well. They're probably correct. Now, if they ate organic grapes, then we know they're correct. For those who are over 50, which is a pretty good-sized part of this audience, though, interestingly enough, I don't know how many of you have come to the recent premieres or the lectures, a lecture down in Miami, a lecture in San Francisco, a lecture in Los Angeles, all very immediately behind us. Probably 75% of the audience were under 30 years of age. So there's a growing body of young people interested in social issues and health. But for those of you over 50, here's the latest, and this is important because I'm doing a major study right now. I haven't talked about it, about growing old in America. And I'm filming senior citizens. In fact, I'm going to play you something in a few moments I think you'll find enjoyable. But it's speaking not just to seniors but older individuals. Here's the latest study for those who are 50. This was done at the University College in London, and it was part of the English Longitudinal Study of Aging. It says, over 50s who enjoy life more are living longer. I'll quote this. People over 50 who enjoy living life, according to this study, are going to have at least another decade onto their life, 10 years. So that's important. That's a major study. Also, there's a lot of people, and they're looking at the economic, social, psychological, and health concerns of an aging society. And so what does this mean in lay language? What can we take away from this? Something I've been suggesting for a long time, and I know many of you actually actualize this. And let me give you an example of this. I'll give you two examples. One is from 20 years ago. At the Jewish Center, which I used to use to hold all my lectures before I got my place on 92nd Street, they had an enormous hall there, and we would have 300-400 people in there. And I did a study, lifestyle modification study, on being overweight. Now, to get into the study, which is a six-month study, you had to be overweight or obese or morbidly obese, and we had all, for at least 2 years. The average person was obese, not just overweight. And I divided the study up into five groups. And each group met once a week. So here's what we did. One group, we gave the perfect dietary input, the amount of fiber, the types of fibers, blending soft fibers in the intestine like blueberry and raspberry and apple pectins with Jerusalem artichoke, vitamin C, fennel, things we know that will really clean out your intestine, get your bowels moving, get that peristalsis, that wave-like rhythmic movement so you're not constipated, get you hydrated so you're not suffering from dehydration in the gut, probiotics, the diet that would help burn fat, everything to clean, detoxify. That was one group. Another group was exercise, every type of exercise. Taking them into the park, we would start our meetings early. We would start them at 5 o'clock. So we would be out in the park at Central Park, which is only a block and a half away, and then we'd come into the Jewish Center to finish off. Then we had a group of stress management. Every type of stress technique imaginable, de-stressing, from hypnosis, regressive hypnosis, meaning finding what happened earlier in your life that you had blocked or were no longer conscious of that was actually causing your behavior today, and journal writing, prayer, all forms of biofeedback. And we had the best experts, Lloyd Glauberman, Donald Mullins, Albert Ellis. If they were someone who helped people, had a good reputation, they were one of our keynote speakers. And these workshops were 3 hours. He really got in-depth information. Another was all about vitamins, every kind of vitamin known to rebalance the body biochemistry and help. And then finally, we had one that dealt with life's issues only. Nothing about diet, exercise, stress management, food. This was strictly about, we ask a question, whose life have you been living and why? And how do you find out who you authentically are? If virtually all the tapes in your subconscious are programmed to defend your current mindset. At the end of 6 months, we had approximately an average of about 92% failure in all the groups. They began to lose a little weight, gained it all back. We had a 93 to 95% success in the people who looked at life. That taught me a lot, that what a person believes in, what are their perceptions, then becomes the basis for all the other choices they make, their political choices, their social choices, their relationship choices, how they raise their children, their views of life itself, how they deal with fear, insecurity, anxiety, uncertainty, how likely they are to abide by social contracts, even when the social contracts are morally reprehensible and wrong. So that then became the basis of all of the counseling, all of the advice I give. And yet that is one of the most difficult places for people to start. They want to start with something easy. They want to start with a diet or with exercising. That's fine, but rarely does it lead to sustainable change that works. But when you get through that emotional minefield, blindfolded, then everything else falls into place. So what this study is showing is that by the time you hit 50 or older, you've met with a lot of challenges. So at least you understand what your priorities are or should. And if you're happy with your life, if you find waking up in the morning, you feel joy, that you feel blessed and gifted to have another day on this planet, then the likelihood is you're going to make choices that are better for you. Not perfect, but better for you. And that's what I found when I traveled around the world. The people who lived the longest lifespans without major disease were not the wealthiest, not the most accomplished, not the busiest, not the most successful, not the best liked, but rather they were happy with their lives. They were comfortable in their own psyche. And that's what this is showing. So once again, I'm glad this study was done. The reference to the study is The Dynamics of Aging, Evidence from the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, 2002-2010. So we have to refocus, recalibrate. Are we bringing balance to each part of our life? Starting with what is the basic foundation, the value of who we are as a human being. You get to that level, then everything else becomes easier. So that's good. I'm happy with that. Hopefully people who are out there, and I know thousands and thousands and thousands, almost 40,000 have gone through our health support groups since then, and that's the foundational issue of all of our achievements. If you have depression, be concerned, because it makes you at a greater risk for bladder cancer. And if you have bladder cancer, you have a higher risk of dying if you are depressed. And if you've eaten things or had foods that create these shortening of the telomeres. Now, let me explain this. This is a study that was done at the International Conference in the Frontiers in Cancer Prevention Research at MD Anderson. Here's what it says. Quote, we found that patients with bladder cancer with shorter telomeres and higher levels of depression symptoms have a 300% increased risk of death. What does this mean in lay language? Well, let's back it up and take each piece. First, telomere. The length of the telomere literally is the biological clock in your body. And you have a biological clock in your heart. Why do you think I've emphasized so much that by exercising daily to an aerobic capacity, meaning where you're really huffing and puffing, you couldn't carry on a normal conversation. If you can exercise, carry on a conversation, then you're not exercising hard enough. But when you do it for an hour, you're actually bringing down your pulse rate when you're resting. Let's say it was 70 beats per minute. Then you exercised. Now after 3 months, it's 65 beats. And then after 6 months, a year, it's 60 beats per minute. You've added years onto your lifespan. First, because we find the higher the pulse rate, the sooner death and more heart attacks and strokes. And then I did an average of the people who I personally work with. That's a lot of people. And I find that when they, and I take everyone's pulse and they get their blood pressure done, and I find that when I'm able to lower the blood pressure and I'm able to lower the pulse rate, those people live an average of 10 years longer. That's an average, some even more. And how you do it is you understand that at the end of your chromosomes, you have little caps, and those are called telomeres. So when you have coffee or soda or aspartame or MSG in a Chinese meal, or you have fried foods or refined carbohydrates, you have the toast, the bagel, the pancakes, the waffles, the things you love that everyone likes to eat, each and every one of those things impacts telomerase. Now, you've heard me mention that you put a plump, moist chicken into a stove, and 2 hours later you take it out and it's brown and crisp. That's glycation. Gly, G-L-Y, cation. Now, glycation is where you change the protein and the sugars. You alter them in chemical ways that makes them very hard for the body to process, and that speeds up telomerase. You want to slow telomerase down When you exercise, you slow it down. When you drink grape juice and you have fresh salads and you have beans and sunflower seeds and pumpkin seeds and sesame seeds and nut butters and raw almond butter and pistachio butter, you slow it down. When you fast one day each week with just juices, you slow it down. When you take in just the calories you need, you slow it down and you lengthen the telomeres. Now, when you take certain nutrients like L-carnosine and resveratrol and alpha-lipoic acid, you extend the lifespan even more. And so when I say that we know how to slow down the aging process, we know how to change your biochemistry, the science is there to support it. I have a major film. It's done, sitting, waiting for me to get back off my efforts on behalf of all of the people who hopefully will turn out and who are getting other people to turn out to vote yes on Proposition 37. We want our food labeled in California, and hence it'll spread across the United States. That, by the way, today the Los Angeles Times, no surprise there, voted no. It doesn't want genetically modified food labeled. Said it's too confusing, too much of a hassle to the shopkeepers. Nonsense. But that was a foregone conclusion. You know, we know how they're going to do on almost every issue. They're pro-establishment right down the line. In any case, I'm going to be doing a major PBS station premiere of this, along with a book that goes with it on anti-aging. And I've got all the studies, the latest studies from all over the world. We can slow down the aging process. So when you eat the wrong foods and you drink the wrong beverages and you stress yourself, all of that is prematurely aging, and that shortens your telomeres, and that's the biological marker for aging associated with cancer development. But when you're depressed, you significantly impact bladder cancer death. So if you have bladder cancer, my suggestion is get yourself some holistic, humanistic counseling so that you don't allow the emotions you're feeling then speed up the death process. And finally, social rejection can now be shown linked to immune response to later health outcomes. This is from Medical News Today. It's from Clinical Psychological Sciences, done at the University of British Columbia. I'll quote this. No matter which way you look at it, rejection hurts. Experiencing rejection from a boss, a friend, or a partner is difficult enough for many adults to handle. But adolescents who are dealing with the 1-2 punch of biological and social change may be the most vulnerable to its negative effects. This scientific research shows that the human immune response is linked to social stressors like rejection, and then later mental and physical health outcomes. Now, we know that there are many kinds of stressors that increase our risk for disease, but stressors that threaten our social standing, like making us feel bad, those are particularly harmful. And here's what it says, quote, many people are probably familiar with targeted rejection from their school days when a student was actively and intentionally rejected by another student or group of students. It's the kind of behavior that we see in so many cases of ostracism and bullying. Targeted rejection is central to some of life's most distressing experiences, things like getting broken up with, getting fired, and being excluded from your peer group at school. In this study, we aim to examine processes that may give these experiences the ability to affect health. And that's exactly what they found. Here's also the takeaway message from this. And I remembered as a kid, one instance just stands out where we were all going out to a lake to go swimming in the summer. And we piled in the car and there wasn't room for one of the buddies. And so the guys were going to drive off, and we got about 10 feet, and I said, stop the car. I said, Steve Shadan, you know, this was guy's name, nice guy, one of my friends. I said, how would you feel if you were left behind? Oh, blah, 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 blah. So I got out of the car. I said, you all go, I'll stay with Steve. So I walked over, and he was standing there. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, you know, I didn't want to go swimming. He says, no? I said, no. Let's go do something else. Okay. And then later in our conversation, a little glimpse into his psyche that his father, and I didn't know this, his father had been very dismissive of him and always favored his older brother. And his brother was a really nice guy and liked by everyone. And Steve was a nice guy, but not liked by everyone. He was very quiet, very shy. And then when I saw, and he explained the dynamic in his family, his father yelled at him all the time, called him stupid, said that, you know, you'll never amount to anything. In effect, he ostracized him. He rejected him. And that rejection, Steve had terrible acne. And he also had some psoriasis on his scalp. And I was thinking, didn't know it at the time, I didn't have the knowledge I have now. But I was thinking, gee whiz, what would it be like to grow up in a family where you were always fearful that when someone spoke to you, if they didn't like how they were feeling, you'd get blamed for it. And what would you do when you're young and you have no defense? You have no capacity to do anything. You have to be the sponge for someone else's negativity. Later, when I was able to start counseling people, one of the first things I would ask them is, do you believe that anything that was done in your early childhood could have affected how you behave today? And most time people say, no, I was all right. And then you get into the details and you find out it wasn't all right. A lot of people are embarrassed to talk about this. For example, if a young girl is rejected by her father, one of two things are likely to happen. One is she's very probable to become obese, to be very nerdish, to study. I'll show you, you know, you may not think I'm lovable. You may not think I'm beautiful. You may not think, but I'm going to show you I'm going to become famous. I'm going to become smarter. And so you'll see these people kind of isolate themselves and work overtime to achieve something. And they generally do. It doesn't make them any happier. Because once they grow up, they're still going to tend to be socially isolated, highly opinionated, and then the type of negative love or affection or feelings that they got from their father, because sometimes that's all they know, they will project towards other people. They become perfectionist towards other people, but not themselves. In other words, they set themselves beyond reproach and judge everyone else. Have you ever gone to the internet and look at how many really sick and disturbed people spend their whole day texting? That's a person that doesn't have a life. You shouldn't be on the internet more than like 5 minutes a day. Any more than that, you don't have a life. This becomes your distraction. And almost always your distraction is going to be on criticizing other people for what you have failed to achieve in your own life. And that gets to this whole idea of why do we have so many damn negative people in our society? And where do they come off feeling they have a right to criticize other people who are actually doing something with their lives, who are happy, whether it's a family person, a man or a woman, even companies? We love, as a society, to project our anger, our hostility, our insecurity, our dysfunction, our toxic energy upon other people. And then you get with other people and you start this whole bantering and sharing and you get these threads. I wouldn't waste 2 seconds of my life on this. I'd rather take an ice pick and stick it in my eye. I'm not going to communicate with these people. I feel sorry for them. I'm not angry with them. I just think it's pathetic that that is a substitute for life. It is not. Before you judge others for having a life, question yourself for why you don't. If the only way you can communicate with people is through toxic, negative, gossiping, and bitching, and moaning, and then expecting other people to live up to a standard, and you have no standards, do you ever notice the people who criticize other people have no standards themselves? They fail at everything. So they hide it. Over the internet, you can fail at everything in life except being toxic and then you succeed because you're with hundreds of millions of other people who are equal in their capacity to be negative. Well, I always ask, how did you make it a better day today? How's the world a better place because you woke up this morning? How are people touched and enlightened and warmth in their heart? How do you make people feel? Or is your nature one of harsh confrontation? And who likes harsh confrontation? I don't. Do you? Do you feel better when confronted? Do you feel better when someone finds something that they can depict you as being negative? And then look at the way people try to control you. Almost always, people control by demeaning. First line, when someone tries to put you down because they can't control you or control the outcome of what you're going to do, get yourself away from that person because it's never going to get better. You go back into that person's life and watch how many times as a child they were put down. They were controlled. They're just reenacting. They become their mother or father all over again. They just don't know it. And their ego won't allow them to acknowledge it. That's what this study shows. And that is pervasive in our society today. The put-down nature. The highly critical and judgmental nature. If you're going to send someone a letter or an email that honors that person. We should be sharing joy and love, encouragement, and positive energy with one another. Not our bitterness, our anger, our hatreds, our biases, our prejudices. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment where we're going to take a look at some of the issues that are very important. I'm going to have a brief interview, a newsmaker interview with my guest, Heidi Stevenson. And then I'm going to spend the remainder of the program offering a progressive challenge to the two debaters from last evening. Please stay with us. Let's go to my guest right now. She is standing by in the United Kingdom. She is Heidi Stevenson. As I gave you her bio earlier, she is a leading health advocate, investigative journalist, and she also is a practicing homeopath, and she is a member of the World Homeopathic Community, and she publishes a column and edits the British health website, Gaia Health, gaia-health.com. Nice to have you with us today, Heidi.
Hi, thanks.
Heidi, I read the article that you wrote, and let me just quote the leading part of it here. The British medical journalist published the case report of a healthy 16-year-old Australian girl whose womanhood appears to have been stolen by Gardasil vaccinations. She has been thrust into full-fledged menopause, her ovaries shut down forever before becoming a woman. The authors of the study draw direct attention to the fact that though the girl had been thoroughly examined and tested, there is no known explanation other than the series of three Gardasil vaccinations she received. Making matters worse is that there have been many other cases, but most are likely masked by the routine treatment of irregular and scanty menstruation or with oral contraceptives. Indeed, it's only because this girl refused them that the truth of her situation was unmasked. Just how many other girls have lost their chance at womanhood but don't know because their condition is masked? All right, that's from an article you've written. Now, we're going to take on two issues here today. The second one's going to be about genetic engineering and gene silencing, something the American public has not heard before. Mm-hmm. Give us the primary reasons why you're opposed to Gardasil, the scientific and verifiable evidence you have to challenge the efficacy and safety of Gardasil, and the bad science that managed to get out in the United States and in England that supports Gardasil.
That's a lot to cover in a very short period of time. I hate to say it, but this is echoing, so I'm having a little bit of difficulty. I'm very sorry. Am I coming through clearly now?
We can hear you all right.
Okay, and the echo is gone, so we're fine. Thanks. I'm sorry. Gardasil is, number one, is it was never properly tested. Of course, no vaccines really are when you get down to it. But Gardasil is, in particular, unique in that it uses an ingredient that has never been used in a vaccine before, that's L-histidine, which has a particularly risky aspect because L-histidine is found in the body naturally. And so that means we're injecting something in an abnormal way into the body, which means that it could be seen as something to attack, which is basically what you're trying to accomplish with any vaccine. And we don't know at this point whether that's actually happening or not. We just know that we're having an awful lot of very extremely negative reactions to Gardasil.
Give us your reasons why you're opposed to Gardasil.
It was never properly tested. It is, we've obviously seen a great deal of bad reactions to it. And finally, the really significant issue is that it's never been shown to prevent cancer. Matter of fact, we've never even seen a cause and effect connection between the HPV virus and cancer, cervical cancer. So we don't even know that the vaccine can do what it claims to do.
And what is the proof of your allegations?
Well, the proof of my allegations is, frankly, the utter lack of studies to demonstrate what they're claiming. That's really very simply it. There's no proof for the claims that are being made.
All right. Let's now go to studies from Australia about genetically modified wheat and how the technology of gene silencing works, why you're concerned about it, and what if two of the leading scientists who have spoken out on it, what they have to say on it.
Okay, this is really a very frightening thing. Genetically engineered wheat, of course, we've had a lot of it all along, but this is a new twist on the whole thing. What they're doing is silencing genes. This is an organization of the Australian government, and they are acting as a like a private corporation. They're treating what they're doing as proprietary information, just like any corporation would. So they're not giving out much information about it. They plan to profit off it. The silenced genes, if they're silenced, they're permanently silenced. And the genes that they're silencing in this particular instance have an analog in the human body. And if that gene in the human body is silenced, then the result in a child born with this gene inactive is the child will not survive past age 5 at the most. So this is a deadly situation. But what makes it particularly bad, what these reviewers of this issue have discussed, is that we know that this gene can be silenced simply by eating the genetically engineered material and having it transfer into the body and therefore and acting on our genes. So the potential is devastating. And yet it was never considered, simply never considered. And that is basically what the two researchers, Heinemann and Carmen, have discussed and are very concerned about.
At what stage is all this research?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Australia seems to think that they're basically done with most of their research in terms of considering any potential harm. They're basically saying there isn't any. They have not considered the potential of the silencing of the gene. They haven't considered any potential increased risk of allergies or risk of cancer. They haven't considered whether these genes can be inherited, and yet there are strong indications that they can be. So they're ready to just go out there with it and start seeing if they can actually produce, grow the wheat properly. they're not doing any of the actual research they should be doing to protect the public's health.
All right. Well, I appreciate the articles you've written, and they're on your website, Gaia, GAIA-health.com. Thank you very much for being on our Newsmaker update, Heidi, and please keep us aware of anything that happens in this field. If it's important on GMOs, we're going to get it out to our audience worldwide immediately.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being on your show.
Okay, Heidi Stevenson. Now, I'm going to take some time to share my thoughts on the discussion last night. And it's what was not said that concerns me. And what was said, I felt, was not rebutted by a third person who would have been independent of the existing system. For example, when Mitt Romney was talking, and as well as Obama, they both praised the military-industrial complex, making us strong, being a world leader. We don't need a large military or a strong military in order to be a world leader. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, were both world leaders, but they had no army behind them. They had wisdom. They had a spiritual philosophy to live by, and yet they were strong activists. Could you imagine if we changed our diplomatic approach around the world to trying to heal the wounds that we have inflicted, to show that we are, as a people, peaceful? They use the word peace multiple times, but it's a hollow word when they use it. Also, Romney's words that economic crisis is the biggest threat, he is not correct. Admiral Mullins, that he likes to quote, actually states that the Pentagon found climate change to be the nation's greatest single threat. And that leads to impoverishment and greater instability around the world and at home. Now, in that respect, I want to share a few specifics with the scholarship to back it up. First, from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, they announced the world food crisis impact on U.S. drought. Food prices skyrocket as individuals and livestock suffer. Quote, after experiencing the most widespread drought in 50 years, corn and soybean prices in the United States soared to record highs over the summer. Compounded with the droughts in Europe and Central Asia, there has been concern about a possible food shortages, raising fears of renewed crisis. An ear of corn from a Missouri farm last year left compared to one from this year, and you see an enormous difference. The difference is that the one from last year was robust and healthy. This year, dry, and they can't sell that. Well, that means that those countries around the world that rely upon the United States for their corn or their wheat or their rice are going to pay more for it, which means fewer people will be able to afford it. Now, that gets to another system, and this is important. This is from The Observer, from John Vital, and this is based upon official statistics. The global food supply system could collapse in the next 12 months. With experiencing major hunger crisis, I'll quote, world grain reserves are so dangerously low that severe weather in the United States or other food exporting countries could trigger a major hunger crisis in the next 12 months. And this is also from the UN. The food crisis is growing in the Middle East and Africa. Failing harvests in the United States, the Ukraine, and other countries this year have eroded reserves to their lowest level since 1974. Now, here's what's important, and here's what they didn't touch on. The U.S. now holds in reserve a historically low 6% of the maize that it expects to consume in the next year. What about the other 94%? We don't have it. Quote, we've not been producing as much as we are consuming. That is why stocks are being run down. Supplies are now very tight across the world, and reserves are at a very, very low level, leaving no room for unexpected events next year, end quote, said a Dr. Abison, senior economist with the FAO. And with food consumption exceeding the amount grown for six of the past 11 years, countries have run down reserves So the average country right now has just 107 days of food. And that is not enough to support a society, a nation. And prices of main food crops such as wheat and maize and corn have gone up in 25 countries. And that's going to lead to major food crisis. Right now, 1 billion people, 1 billion, are food insecure. Also, this is a new study. And this comes from Complex System Institute and MIT's Technology Review. Quote, we are now 1 year away from global riots, complex systems theorists say. I'll quote this verbatim. What's the number one reason we riot? The plausible, justifiable motivations of trampled upon human folk to fight back are many. Poverty, oppression, disenfranchisement. But the big one, the number one, is more primal than any other. It's hunger, plain and simple. If there's a single factor that reliably sparks social unrest, it's food becoming too scarce or too expensive. So argues a group of complex systems theorists at Cambridge University. And they have published this in their peer review paper. So once again, we have some of the world's leading theorists looking at why we rebel, what causes riots, and they don't even touch on this. But then again, they don't touch upon the environmental factors at all. In fact, according to 350.org in Common Dreams, they spend 270 minutes of silence. Obama and Romney quote climate change silence deafening. I'll quote this. Following three national televised debates, corporate polluters have bought the silence of our elected leaders, so it's time for us to take the lead. Not a word, not one word, Jamie Henn was saying from 350.org, from the climate change, and after 270 minutes of presidential and vice presidential debates, no one has mentioned climate change or global warming. That's after a country, the United States, broke 17,000 heat records this summer. Drought smothered half of all the states in the United States, destroyed our corn crop. Millions of acres of American West went up in smoke. So, you think that maybe that's important to deal with? You wouldn't know it. Nothing was discussed. From Tira Daly, from Johannesburg, South Africa. Too late to stop global warming by cutting emissions. This is scary. I'll quote this. Governmental institutions should focus on developing adaptation policies to address and mitigate against the negative impact of global warming, rather than putting the emphasis on carbon trading, which to me is a fraud, and capping greenhouse gas emissions, argued Johannesburg Wits University geoscientist James Knight and Dr. Stephen Harrison at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. Quote, at present, government's attempts to limit greenhouse gas emissions through carbon cap and trade schemes and to promote renewable and sustainable energy sources are probably too late to arrest the inevitable trend of global warming. And that was in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Climate Change. So what they're saying in this article is, it's too late. And out there 7 years producing this major book, which is already 1,300 pages, and this gigantic document I'm doing, the most comprehensive and complicated I've ever produced and directed, on the 12 tipping points, four of the tipping points have tipped. What we're doing now is we're seeing the outcome with these. This winter we'll have the hottest winter, then we'll have the coldest days, then we'll have the most snow, then we'll have the most rain. We'll have the greatest degree of change in ocean temperature. All these things are happening because it's tipped. And they're saying, you better prepare people to adapt because we're not going to change. And let us face it, we could knock out 18% of all global warming if we switch to a vegan diet. But we're not going to do that. And that's not even discussed. Next up, scenes from the Great Despo. You would have thought this would have gotten in someone's mindset. I'm sure many people in this audience have parents who went through Despo days. Mine did. Where you would go outside and you would see nothing as far as you could see but dust. Sometimes the dust in some places would be so intense that they even had a new disease because of how it got into the lung cavities and the sinus cavities and the lungs, and it killed people. Here's the latest. Scenes of Dust Bowl days return as Oklahoma storm causes highway pileup. Year of high temperatures and record drought portends climate future of once fertile croplands. Dramatic video footage and eyewitness accounts from Oklahoma just last week tell the story of a scene right out of the Depression-era Dust Bowl days as a massive windswept cloud of reddish-brown dirt made invisibility the impossible, visibility impossible on a stretch of the highway going from Oklahoma City to Kansas City, Missouri. The Midwestern states have experienced some of the highest temperatures on record this year, and severe drought has devastated corn crops and turned once thriving green fields to brown, dried dirt. Scientists make direct connections between these trends and the growing impact of climate change fueled by human-caused climate change. Quote, I've never seen anything like this, Jody Palmer, a dispatcher for the Kay County Sheriff's Office, told the Associated Press. Quote, in this area alone, the dirt is blowing because we've been in drought. I think from the drought, everything's so dry and the wind is high. You have the perfect combination of extended drought in that area. We have the extreme strong winds. So now we have new dust bowls. Now think of what that means to the people living in Indiana and Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma. It means you're in the wrong place for sustainability. Dust bowls, drought, no water, not being able to grow food, that is the new norm for you. Then we have this. This is from Joseph Nevins of Common Dreams, The Privilege of Being Human, Ecological Crisis, and the Need to Challenge the 20%. I'll quote this. Although you would not know it from what passes for debate during the ongoing presidential campaign, here in the United States, the biosphere is under siege. A historically high rate of ice melt in the Arctic, devastating floods from the Philippines to Nigeria, a record-setting decline in Australian Great Barrier Reef, and extreme levels of drought in much of the United States are just some of the recent manifestations. These worrisome signs highlight, among other things, the tragic failure of the international community to slash consumption of the Earth's resources via binding international mechanisms. And while the reasons for this are numerous, a key one is the obstruction by some of the world's wealthiest, most powerful countries and their refusal to renounce the gospel of endless economic growth. But also central is a combination of refusal by and seemingly inability of members of the planet's ecologically privileged class, let's call them the 20 percenters, to see their very ways of life and their associated gargantuan levels of consumption as problems in need of radical redress. To appreciate this, one needs look no further than a much-talked-about article, one with foreboding news for those interested in sustaining human life on the planet as we know it. It appeared in the journal Nature shortly before the ballyhooed but ultimately fruitless UN Earth Summit opened in June in Rio de Janeiro. Due to human-induced changes in the biosphere, the article asserts, the world is quite possibly approaching, quote, critical transition, end quote. It is one, quote, with the potential to transform Earth rapidly and irreversibly into a state unknown in human experience. Let me repeat this again. We are going to change the Earth rapidly and irreversibly into a state unknown in human experience, end quote. A significant decline in biodiversity, a fossil fuel-induced growth in atmospheric greenhouse gases, deforestation, the melting of the glaciers, large dead zones in coastal marine areas are just some of the myriad indications of the extent to which humans have altered the biosphere and the drivers of the planetary-scale critical transition. As a review of already published material, the article's findings are in some ways significant because it reminds us of how much we've consumed and what it cost. And then he gives an example. Talks about, in this case, quote, the ludicrous nature of this position immediately struck me as I read a revealing article about New York City's billionaire mayor Michael Bloomberg. He had recently bought a 33-acre estate for $4.5 million. This is his third home in Westchester County, just north of New York City. He also has three in Manhattan, one in nearby Long Island, one in Colorado, one in Florida, one in London, and one in Bermuda, to where he regularly flies in his private jet. I'd also just received an email from Barack Obama, at least it purported to be. In it, he promised if I made a financial contribution to his reelection campaign to automatically enter me into a drawing, the handful of winners, he wrote, would be flown from their home areas to have dinner with him. To own 12 homes or to be able to fly supporters across long distances to join you for dinner are obscene displays of wealth and power, given the environmental degradation resulting from the resource consumption they embody. They are obscenities that an emphasis on average rate in the form of per capita consumption only serves to obscure. Yet while highly extreme, such levels of consumption are the pinnacle of grossly unequal levels of resource use, ones that largely correspond to the divisions related to overlapping categories of race, class, and nation. He goes on to talk about how much the average American, using their gas-driven clothes dryers and their computers and their cell phones and their central heating and air conditioning and their cars and their food, how much we consume, how much we produce. And it's staggering. A single round-trip flight from New York to London produce in terms of its impact on the climate the equivalent of 2 metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions per economic class passenger. That's more than the emissions produced by an average resident living in Brazil for an entire year. So the takeaway message of this is, those who live simply and close to the earth, those individuals are not polluting the planet. The rest of us are, if we're consuming more than what we need. So to the president and to Barack Obama, to Mitt Romney, you chose not to talk about at all, not a word, about the world we live in, the non-sustainability of all your policies, your clean coal, which is an oxymoron, it doesn't exist, supporting green energy like nuclear. It is not green. I did a one-hour program with the best minds in America on nuclear energy last night. You can go to the archives and listen to it on the Progressive Commentary Hour. You're supporting all the wrong energies. You're supporting military-industrial complex. You say we need this in order to be safe. We do not. I have today up on my website about a 45-page report that I wrote on how we can put millions to work, reduce our debt, without having any money taken away from social programs, actually to increase social spending and to increase spending on infrastructure we desperately need, how to de-ghettoize America. And that's what we should be focusing attention on, not this preposterous military-industrial complex. And just a word on that, there are reports that I have from the Government Accounting Office showing in just one single episode they wasted, the military-industrial complex, the defense budget, wasted $70 billion, including on the F-35 Joint Striker Fighter. After it was developed, it was canceled. And then we also have $100 billion, billion wasted in 1 year, on an insane program called Future Combat System. That after Secretary of Defense Robert Gates decided in 2009 that the project wasn't ready for him, he canceled it. Billions lost. We have corporate welfare waste for military contractors. That's about one-third of all the money we spend each year in the military-industrial complex. And also, both candidates permit phony capitalism to creep into dictating the Pentagon budget, regardless of what the Pentagon actually needs. And they keep saying, but we're going to let the Pentagon. The Pentagon in itself is systemically fraudulent. They allowed an incredible amount of theft in Iraq without ever following up to see who got the $16 trillion went missing. They had $300 billion in cost overruns on 72 weapon system acquisitions from Boeing and Northrop Grumman. $13 billion in cash, hard cash currency, that was sent to Iraq disappeared, making it the greatest debt in history. And then because of that and the cost overruns, they gave the very people who lost the money and who overspent $8 billion in performance bonuses without any consideration. Do you also know this? I'm going to end with this. Do you know that the U.S. military has built 140 deep underground military bases? Deep underground military bases, they're called dumbs because the general public, they believe, is too dumb to realize. Worldwide, there are 15,000 deep underground military bases. And these have been built since the 1940s. They average the size of a small city, 10 to 30 miles across with an average depth of 4 miles. They're carved out by massive nuclear-powered laser drilling machines and connected by underground mega-levitrain lines. The bases are stocked with food and supplies and have the ability to grow crops with artificial lighting. Well, the question is, why haven't we been told of these humongous networks? Why are they secret? But then again, the United States, and they were wrong on their statistics last night, the United States will spend $1.3 trillion on and off the books for a military-industrial complex. If you add China, $143 billion, Russia, $71 billion, United Kingdom, $62 billion, France, $62 billion, Japan, $59 billion, and all the other countries in the world combined, we're three times higher than the rest of the world combined. So we don't need to be spending all that money, and we're not going to become any safer because of it. Those are some of my rebuttal concepts and comments on last night. Your turn, Luann.
Okay. Well, I had a couple of questions come in, and it's all about one particular area, and that is there are a lot of people that are very righteous about their anger towards you. And I'm specifically talking about your work on these stations like Pacifica. And then in spite of that, you raise more money than anyone else on the station. What I see, Gary, is that they don't support any of your cutting-edge programs, none of your rallies, your demonstrations. I don't see any of them at your premieres. I don't hear them promoting your premieres throughout the day. And yet, you raise the most money for them. So I have something here from Tyrone from Harlem, and all he writes to me is, why do they keep playing you so much on WBAI?
Well, I would look at it this way. When you look at what you're trying to achieve as a radio station, and the audience is abandoning you at 70,000 per year, you either have to replace that audience or you go out of business. In the last 2 years, I brought them over 100,000 new listeners, $2 million in contributions, and some important programming. I do not bring it there to make friends with the producers. They have never been my friends. They have their own agendas, and I do not know what they are, and I have no right to judge them. If a person doesn't show up for a demonstration, that doesn't mean they're a bad person. They may show up for a different type of demonstration. They could believe that what I'm doing against nuclear or against genetic engineering or against gas hydrofracking are not relevant, and therefore they may feel something else they're doing is more relevant, and that's absolutely their right. At the end of the day, I'm there because I helped support at one time what I felt was one of the most progressive radio stations in the country, which it was, but then it fell on hard times. It went through a really difficult time, and now they said that if we bring an audience back and we get them out of the financial crisis, that they will be a responsible station again. We have to see. I haven't seen that yet. I haven't seen the kind of programming and management decisions that they're really willing to commit themselves first and foremost, not to an ideology, not to defending their own jobs, but rather to supporting quality information going over the air from a diverse group of individuals that are not simply politically attached. Just being on the left and supporting the leftist views is not enough to warrant most people wanting to listen to him today. And that's why they're having a hard time keeping their audience. I wish that they would change, but in the end, that's their choice. So if they want to be angry at the fact that my audience is a positive audience, and then that's their choice. But we're going to continue doing good broadcasting on the important topics with quality people because we have a quality audience. It's vital, it's progressive, it's proportionally younger than ever before, and they care about their future. I would hope that in the next 12 months that the station brings on much more progressive programming and that they build their audience. That's my hope for them. But I don't get myself involved in other people's anger issues. Who was it? Montaigne, the great philosopher, who said, "There's no passion so much transports the sincerity of judgment as doth anger." So a lot of people are self-righteous in their anger, but they never look at what they're really angry about. Almost always when people are angry, they're angry at something that is incomplete in themselves. They're merely projecting it at others. Thanks for your call. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a great day, everyone.